Well, the last few weeks we've been in this series called Housework, and we've been exploring in the series what it looks like all the way back in the first week to honor our parents, to give them honor. And then we spent the next week wrestling with the kind of questions that we ask when we're single and how those same questions affect us regardless if we're single or in a relationship. And then last week we dived into love and marriage and all the dynamics that play itself out there. And then this week, I want us to wrap up the series by diving into some questions that I believe are worth asking as a parent. Now, again, as we've said all throughout this series, I don't believe that you have to be a parent at all to take away some helpful things this morning, because the issues I want to get into really affect all types of relationships. But many of us, regardless if you're a parent or not, or whether you hope to be one day, most all of us have the opportunity to impact kids' lives in some way, whether that's as an aunt or an uncle or a parent or a teacher, a coach, a neighbor, a small group leader. There's several different ways that we all have the opportunity to impact kids' lives. But this morning, I'm mostly going to allude to the role of parents, and I'm going to trust that everyone can draw some appropriate insights and applications to their own lives, regardless if you're a parent or not. Now, one of the tensions I'll put on the table early is that it's pretty obvious I haven't traveled all the way through the most hands-on parenting years yet. For those of you who don't know, I've got two young boys. I have a 7-year-old and a 9-year-old. Actually, my youngest, Trace, turns 7 tomorrow, and so we're kind of in the midst of celebrating that. If you see him in the halls, you can give him some birthday love. But while I haven't traveled nearly as many parenting years as some of you, I have had a front row seat, to hundreds, if not to thousands of families' lives the past 16 years as a pastor. And in that time, I've seen enough patterns play themselves out consistently that I've been able to glean at least a few insights that I believe can be helpful and not only serve as reminders to myself, because I need these kinds of reminders constantly, but hopefully reminders to all of us. Now, up front, I want to make it clear that the Bible doesn't offer hardly any specific instructions when it comes to parenting. Now, there's many passages that we can draw some incredible wisdom from and apply to parenting and influencing all ages of children and students alike, but there's not much directly specifically toward parenting and the way to go about it. And that can be frustrating at times, because many times what we would prefer is we'd prefer a map of specific guidelines, kind of a step-by-step instruction manual that would help those of us who are parents answer the questions that many of us find ourselves prone to struggle with. For instance, pacifier or no pacifier? You know, let them cry it out or comfort them immediately when they cry. Same bedtime every night, or they go to bed when they're tired. Get a babysitter or never leave the child. Spanking or timeout. TV or no TV. Video games or no video games. Justin Bieber or no Bieber. You know, homeschool or public school. Public school, private school. Facebook, no Facebook. Let them date, let them not date. Curfew, no curfew. And the list goes on and on and on of all the different types of decisions we find ourselves facing. And the Bible doesn't get into any of these type of specific details. And yet, parents are flooded with all these different types of decisions constantly. And as we do, it's important that we remember a couple things. One is that there's no formula on how to parent your kids. This is the one right way to do it. There's no, if you just follow these steps, then everything, you know, will turn out perfectly. If you just make these decisions, your kids will turn out just the way you want them to. Every child is different. Every family's rhythm and dynamic is different. And if you're a parent, understand God has entrusted you with your unique personality, with your unique strengths, and your unique weaknesses to parent your own children. But also know that you can make every right and wise decision imaginable. And all of that doesn't take away from the reality that your child has the freedom of choice, that they have free will. Every right decision on your part cannot prevent that your child will never make some poor decisions or make unwise choices in their lives that lead to a lot of pain, that lead to a lot of heartbreak in their own lives, in other people's lives, even in your own life. And yet, I know some of you find yourself sitting here this morning riddled with guilt, looking back, thinking, you know what? If only I would have done this. If only I would have done that, then they wouldn't have made those choices or those decisions. And you have convinced yourself over time that all of your kids' poor choices are your fault. And yet, as parents, one of the key things to understand is we're not raising robots. We have to remind one another that every child lives with the freedom of choice. And no matter what you do, there is no guarantee that your children will always make wise decisions. There is not one formula on how to do this. No one perfect way when it comes to parenting. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't seek wisdom. It doesn't mean that you ask other parents who are more experienced and have been on this journey longer than you. It doesn't mean that you don't pour over, you know, parenting books and try to glean wisdom from all of them. But what it does mean is that you embrace that God has entrusted you with the responsibility of impacting the children he's placed in your life, whether as a parent, a teacher, a coach, small group leader, whatever that looks like. Now, a second thing that's important for us to remember is that when you bump into struggles as a parent, that you let yourself be reminded that as people striving to pursue God, trying to pursue his way, that you are not alone in your struggle. In fact, nearly every prominent family mentioned in the Bible struggled with huge family dysfunction. I mean, think about it for a moment. Adam and Eve, their firstborn son Cain murdered his brother Abel. This wasn't just bickering over the Wii remote. This wasn't just, you know, arguing who gets the car on Friday night. This was Cain murdering his brother. Noah, many of us are familiar with Noah. Noah got drunk, found himself laid out naked one night, and his son walks in and sees him, and Noah ends up cursing his son and cursing his son's family. Rebecca, another prominent woman in the Bible, she devises a plan with her son Jacob to deceive and manipulate her husband Isaac, and at the same time show preferential treatment to Jacob so that it leaves her other son, Esau, out to dry. Later on, a generation later, Jacob's son beat up their brother Joseph. They throw him in a pit and decide whether they're going to kill him or sell him. And so then eventually they decide to sell him into slavery. King David, the same David who defeated Goliath and would later write many of the Psalms we find in the Bible, he had an affair, he got the woman pregnant, then he had the woman's husband murdered, and then years later he had another son, Absalom, who started a rebellion to overthrow David and to overthrow his own kingdom. Even Joseph and Mary, we would think, okay, well, they're raising Jesus. Of course, they probably did a good job, but even Joseph and Mary lost Jesus for 3 days on a road trip. So understand, when people present this idea of, you know what, you should strive to have a biblical family, that's what biblical family looks like. And I, for one, am very grateful that the scriptures are honest about how things actually were, because it's a reminder that the Bible is about real people living real life. That the Bible is not full of accounts of people living some idealistic fairy tale notion of life. Remember what James says in the New Testament when he writes, "We all stumble in many ways." Now, we reference back to that a lot because it's true. It's so true for us and so important to be reminded of. And while that applies to us as parents, that there are definitely going to be times and occasions when we mess up and when we blow it big time, at times it's harder to remember that that same verse applies to our kids as well. That along the way, they're going to stumble. They're going to mess up. They're going to have emotional outbursts. They're going to have immature reactions to things. And yet, I think one of the easiest traps to fall into as a parent is to let ourselves become completely shocked when they do. To the point where we can way overreact with anger and this look and tone of crushing disappointment. And this way of kind of trying to make them feel as much shame as possible, because there's something in us that responds with shock. How dare you act this way? What in the world is wrong with you? And in that moment, we forget we all stumble in many ways, and that all includes our kids. And just like we talked about last week in the context of marriage, when ugly stuff comes out of us, we first have to learn to pay attention to what's actually going on inside of us. But it's much easier to put all the blame on our kids, that it's their fault, it's something that they've done wrong that is causing us to act this way. But it's much harder, but much more important, to pause and ask questions about what's really fueling the stuff going on inside of us. That we'd ask questions like, you know what, I find myself getting really angry, but is it because I'm really embarrassed? Is that what's going on in me? I mean, I thought it was just what they did, but maybe this is about me. Am I more concerned with what other parents might be thinking of me as a parent right now when they look at my kids, or what they might think of me, or they might think of my parenting when they find out? Or maybe the real issue is it that I'm scared? Is it that maybe what's going on in me, this anger that I'm feeling, it's that I'm so scared my son or daughter is going to turn out like this one particular person from my past that wounded me? That even the slightest reminder of how that one person hurt you and what your son did or what your daughter said, that when you get a glimpse of that, it sends you off the deep end emotionally because you're scared. You're frightened that they may go down that same path. And so here's what I want to do with the rest of our time this morning. What I want to do is I want to focus primarily on what's going on inside of you. What's going on inside of you as a parent or as one who has influence over kids in any area of your life? Because again, you and I can't control everything kids do and say. But what we can do is we can pay attention to what's going on inside of us. So look at me at what God says in Deuteronomy chapter 4. Deuteronomy is in the Old Testament. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, the fifth book. And God is speaking to the Israelite community, to the nation of Israel. And this is what he says. He says, watch yourselves closely so that you do not forget the things your eyes have seen, or let them slip from your heart as long as you live. Teach them to your children and to their children after them. Now again, God is speaking to the nation of Israel. And he says, okay, watch yourselves closely. Pay attention to what's going on inside your hearts. Because as the years go on, don't forget how I've rescued you from slavery from the Egyptians. Don't forget the miracles you've witnessed with your own eyes. Don't forget how the sea parted in front of you. Don't forget how food was provided for you every morning when you woke up. As the years go by and you have this tendency to start to become more self-sufficient and think this is all that you've done on your own, don't forget how I've cared for you. Don't forget how I've provided for you. Don't forget how I've been faithful to you. And he says, teach your children and these things. Teach what you see, what you've seen. Teach it to your children and to their children after them so that they will know what I'm like. Through all the ups and downs of life that certainly will come, that they will know my heart for them, that they will understand my faithfulness to my people. And as a parent, understand, we are often the most tangible expression to our kids of what God is like, of what his heart is like. And so with that sacred opportunity in mind, I want to offer you a few questions to wrestle through as we all learn to watch ourselves, as we all learn to pay attention to what's going on in us as we influence the kids in our lives. And there's a ton of different questions we could ask, but I want to offer you a few that I've been asking and that I've been learning so far at this point in my journey that have been helpful to me and that I hope can be helpful to you. The first one is this, is that when our kids stumble and their behavior goes sideways at times, we need to ask, who is it that I find myself responding to? If it's helpful, maybe you jot these questions down, but who is it that I find myself responding to? For example, let's say you plan a special day with your kids. You take time off work, you rearrange your schedule, you push aside other things to do on your to-do list, and then you spend a nice chunk of change trying to make this day special for them. But a few minutes into it, it seems that all you hear is complaining. You know, all you hear is whining and bickering. Nobody can agree on where you're going to eat, and they're disappointed that you're not doing something else. They're complaining that they don't get to watch the DVD in the car. They're complaining that it's too hot outside. They're complaining that they'd rather be with their friends and going out with them. And there's something in you boiling up that finally comes out like, wait a second, I did all this for you, and this is the thanks I get? Really? You're going to treat me this way after I've done all this? I've rearranged my schedule. I've spent all this money, and this is how you're going to treat me? And it becomes very tempting in that moment. When we pay attention to what's going on inside of us, very tempting in that moment to use guilt and intimidation to get the reaction that we want, to get the appreciation that we want, to get the appreciation that we think and have convinced ourselves we deserve. Or let's say perhaps you save up for months and you sacrifice and you sell things and you go to 20 different stores trying to find this perfect gift for one of your kids. Something that you would think is just incredibly special and thoughtful, and you put all this time and energy into it, and then comes their birthday. And they're opening all their gifts, and they kind of open up the paper, and they look at it, and they go, thanks. And they move it to the side and start opening the next gift. And inside, you're like, whoa, 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 wait a second. You know, where's the backflips? Where's the screeches of joy? Where's the, you're the best dad ever. You're the best mom ever. I can't believe you would get this for me. And what all of a sudden what starts to happen is this no longer is about the gift that you want to bless them with. It becomes about the reaction that you want. It becomes about what you haven't received. Now the birthday gift is about you, not about them. And there's something in you that thinks, fine, you know what? If that's the way that you're going to be, that's the way that you're going to act, that's the last time I'm going to that much trouble. I'm not going to go to that much trouble anymore. I'll just take a card and put some cash in it, you know, and send it to you if that's what you want. I'm not going to try to be thoughtful. I'm not going to try to do any of those things. Now, I want to hit a pause button just for a second in case any of you have checked out and started to think, you know what? If I'm not a parent, this really doesn't apply to me. Understand, what we're talking about applies to everyone and all types of relationships. It just so happens that many times when you become a parent, it magnifies this sense of entitlement that goes on in our own hearts. But it's moments like these that we just described that it's very easy to find yourself reacting to your child's behavior and start to let resentment creep in without even realizing it. And you start to distance yourself from your child emotionally. And that happens when we become a child-centered parent rather than a God-centered parent, where I find myself reacting to their behavior and wanting to withdraw and shame them in getting what I think that they deserve rather than responding to God. Where I would listen to God in the moment and say, God, how is it that you want me to respond to my child rather than reacting to my child's behavior? Because when we react, what we're doing is what the word says. We're reenacting someone else's behavior. So I'm reenacting their poor attitude. I'm reenacting their apathy and choosing, I'll respond to them based on their behavior rather than how am I responding to God and what he would call me to respond to my child in this moment and to move toward them and to reflect his heart to them. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't address and correct disrespectful attitudes and behaviors in your kids. But what it does mean is that in that process, you pause long enough to ask, how does how I'm about to respond to this reflect who it is that I'm responding to? Am I responding to God? Am I seeking to reflect his heart toward my child? Or am I simply reacting to my child's behavior in an equally unhealthy way? A couple weeks ago, my family spent a few days down at Disney World, and I had determined that this was the moment for my youngest son, Trace, who's 7, to ride on his first big boy roller coaster. So I had spent, you know, a couple hours ahead of time talking to him about it and trying to say, man, you know, you can trust Dad, and never going to tell you to do something that's going to hurt you or harm you. And he was nervous about it, but, you know, we got the fast passes, the little tickets to get in line. And so we're waiting in line. We only have about 15 minutes or so to wait. And we have about, you know, 2 minutes left before we're in the seats. And all of a sudden, he makes it very clear that he does not want to go on this ride. And this nervousness creeps up in him and this terror and fear and says, Dad, I don't want to go. And so I find myself getting very frustrated and saying, no, you're going to go, you know? And he's like, I just really don't want to go, Dad. I'm scared. Don't make me go. Please don't make me go. So then I've got, you know, my wife, Adrian, and my oldest son, Caden, with us too. And I'm like, buddy, you can't do this to your family. That means one of you is going to have to sit out, you know, like one of us, your mom or I are going to have to take you and we're going to miss out on the fun of that. And that's not really fair to them, you know, because now I got to pull out all the stops. So how am I going to get him on this ride? And he's just like, you know what, Dad, I just don't want to do it. Please, I don't want to do this. And so finally, I just said, okay, fine. And so I folded my arms and I just sat there looking the other way. And he's like, Dad, I am so sorry. I'm sorry, Dad. And I'm just like, yeah. And I'm just this fuming inside of me. And I'm just sitting there, you know, frustrated. Okay, it's just better I just don't talk. I'll just look the other way. But inside I'm thinking, okay, I got to be that parent. Because then it happened where we get up to the line and they're like, here, you need to come over here. And I was like, yeah, we've got, you know, a kid that needs to get off the ride. And so they're, you know, they have to make all these special, oh, okay, let's figure out how we're doing that. I'm like, oh, great, I'm that parent, you know, and that's me. And And my wife, Adrian, was like, I really don't like roller coasters. I'm fine taking him off the ride, you know? And so he's fine. He's taken care of. But I'm just fuming. And I'm so frustrated at him. And so then we get into the ride to the point where I forgot that this was also my 9-year-old's first kind of big boy roller coaster. So we're sitting on the ride, got my arms folded. He starts putting his arm around me. Dad, it's going to be okay. I'm really sorry Trace acted that way. And I'm just like, yeah. And I'm just rocking, you know, and I'm just so frustrated at him. And so all of a sudden we go through the ride, and again, my brain's just in a totally different place, in a different space. And we get off the ride, and there's my wife, Adrian, and Trace sitting on one of the little benches. And I said, Trace, come over here. I want to talk to you. So came over, and I put him on my lap. And I said, buddy, I need to tell you something. I'm really sorry. And I said, I need to tell you a secret. You know, when I was your age, we went to Disney World. And we got in line for this ride called Space Mountain. And, you know, it was a little different for my dad because he had both me and my sister, and my mom wasn't in line with us. And so we get up to the front of the line, and I was terrified. And I said, Dad, I don't want to go. And I begged and pleaded not to go. And my dad really didn't have any other choice because there was no other parent around. So he just picked me up, plopped me in, locked me in, and we went. And I said, and I was terrified. I screamed the whole time. I was so upset. And I said, it was years later, probably 4 or 5 years later, till I rode another roller coaster again. But then when I rode a roller coaster again, I realized how much fun that they were. And so, buddy, I want you to understand that part of what was going on in me that time when I was very frustrated and not really paying attention to you was because I don't want you to miss out on all the fun that I realized I missed. But at the same time, buddy, I want you to know that whether you ride a roller coaster or not, it's just not that big a deal. And if you don't want to ride it, it's okay. There are going to be things that you're going to need to trust Dad and Mom on, and that we're going to say, you need to do this, and you're going to have to trust us. But if you don't want to ride a roller coaster, it's okay. And I'm sorry that I kind of pushed you away, and I love you. And I just hugged him. And I was thinking of this very question in my head at that moment, you know, okay, who am I going to respond to? Because at first it was, how do I respond to him? And I'm going to react to him and reenact his behavior and how he's making me feel. And this is all about me and how this makes me feel. Rather than, okay, how am I going to move toward my son? How am I going to let him know that, man, that buddy, I love you no matter what? And so that's a question all of us have to ask. We have to ask ourselves, who am I responding to? But another one that I think that we always have to ask is, do I find myself fighting more with my kids or for my kids? Do I find myself fighting more with my kids or for my kids? Because as parents, or really anyone, again, who has influence over kids, sometimes it's easy to forget that you can win the argument with your kids and you can force the right behavior, but you can lose their heart in the process. And as a parent, it's easy to get wound up when our authority gets challenged, that there's something in us that kind of swells up and wants to prove who's actually in charge because somehow we feel threatened. And so we can easily start to fight with our kids rather than for our kids. One author, Carrie Newwoof, he says this. He says, every family fights, but there's a world of difference between when you fight with someone and when you fight for someone. When you fight with someone, you want to win. When you fight for someone, you want that person to win. When you fight with people, walls are built up. When you fight for people, walls come down. When you fight with people, relationships are jeopardized. When you fight for people, relationships are prioritized. See, when we don't get that difference, we become much more skilled. It's easy to become much more skilled at fighting to win an argument with our kids than we become skilled at fighting to win the hearts of our kids. And too often as parents, we can think that the primary goal of parenting is to get our kids to follow rules. And so we emphasize the importance of getting our kids to be trustworthy and following in the rules. And trust me, that is very important. Getting our kids to learn to be trustworthy is huge. But one of the things I'm continuing to discover is that I need to be asking and paying attention to how I am doing it being trustworthy as a parent to my kids, more so than just trying to get them to learn to be trustworthy. Because again, ultimately, I cannot control their choices. I cannot control their decisions, but I can control mine. And their trust in me as a parent can easily be affected when I choose to discipline in anger, when I choose to use words that communicate rejection and shame, when I ignore their voices and I refuse to listen to their perspective, when I don't try to understand who they are, when I don't try to understand their context, when I don't try to listen and understand their feelings, when I tend to take things too personally. And what I'm learning is that their trust in me will actually affect their growth as a person much more so than my trust in them. And yet it's easier to focus on them rather than on me. It's always easier to do that. It's easier to get absorbed into just focusing on molding them into who we think they should be, while all along oblivious to the fact that we could end up fracturing their trust in us and losing their hearts in the process because we got caught up in fighting with them rather than for them. Now, it doesn't mean that you'll do everything right. Doesn't mean that you'll have all the right answers. Doesn't mean you'll always respond the right way, that you'll have the right wisdom, the right explanation all the time. Doesn't mean that you're not going to get tired and worn out of struggling with the same things day after day. Doesn't mean that you're not going to get frustrated when your kid doesn't want to get on the roller coaster and you make it all about you. But what it does mean is that through all those ups and downs that you won't stop fighting for your relationship with your kids. That you won't stop fighting for their hearts. And part of that is being willing to ask another important question. Because often we can tend to forget that when we look at passages like in Deuteronomy chapter 4, that God is speaking to a nation of people. God is speaking to the community of the Israelites about teaching their children. He wasn't speaking to separate family units. He was speaking to the community as a whole. And so while this question was much more assumed some 4,000 years ago, it's not nearly as much today. And the question is simply this: what other adults am I strategically getting involved in my kids' lives? What other adults am I strategically getting involved in my kids' lives? And at first you may hear that question and think, well, that's not as much paying attention to what's going on inside of us. But there's something in us many times that think we need to be the answer to all of our kids' issues and struggles. We can kind of get this Messiah complex that it's all up to us, that it's all dependent on us, that we need to be the end all for our kids. But here's what I know. Your kids aren't going to tell you everything. They're not. I didn't tell my parents everything. I'm sure you didn't either. And especially when you play that out, parents are the ones who make and enforce the rules. And so you're just not going to get told everything. So what we have to embrace is that we can either leave our kids alone to discover random influences who will shape their character, who will shape their faith, who they are as people, or we can help them by getting other adults intentionally and strategically involved in their lives. That's why from toddlers up through seniors in high school here at Cross Point, we're constantly trying to partner with parents to put other trustworthy adult voices in their lives. People who will invest in the life of your child, who will encourage similar character traits and values that you would want to see instilled in your child, because we recognize that it's a critical need to have other adult trustworthy voices speaking into the life of our kids, that we need to do that for one another. So that when something blows up in your kid's world and you say, hey, you know what, I know something is wrong, and you're sitting on the edge of the bed and you're like, would you please talk to me? And they've just shut themselves down. And you're like, come on, you can talk to me, please. Just share with me what's going on. And they look at you and they say, you know what? I don't want to talk to you about it. Rather than trying to intimidate or trying to force, when you wrestle with this question and move toward answering this question, then you can say, okay, well, then tell me who is it that you're going to talk to then? If not me, then who? And when that time comes, when that question comes, when that moment happens, you want your kids to have a name. And you want those kids to have a name that you know. And you want that relationship to already be in place, because the time to start building those relationships isn't when the crisis hits. It's long before that moment, so that the trust is already there. Many times parents, you know, they'll bring in maybe teenagers or young adults, and crisis happens, and they come and they plop them down on my couch in front of me, and they're like, here, you talk to them. And I'm like, man, I don't even, the first time maybe I've met them, and there's no, and I can try to be helpful, but there's no trust there. There's no relationship there. So you've got to say, what am I strategically doing to get other adults involved in my kids' lives? And so maybe you have a trusted friend. Take them out to breakfast once a month during the summer. Pour into them. Ask them questions. Just get to know them. Maybe you get them involved in a small group here at church. You know, we have it from all ages of kids, so that someone else, another adult, will invest in their life. And then you take the time to invest in that small group leader yourself so that they know how valuable they are in partnering with you. You get creative. You do whatever you need to do, but find a way to start expanding their circle of influence, because it's going to happen with you or without you. And so you might as well start early in partnering with them with the influences that both of you can trust, because sometimes those critical voices that are in their life make the huge difference depending on which way things go when crisis hits. Who do they turn to? Who do they talk to? And you want to be intentional about getting other adults in their lives that you can trust. Last question I want to offer you is this, and then this is how we'll wrap this up. And it's, what kind of story am I inviting them into? What kind of story am I inviting them into? Probably about a year ago, I read this book by Donald Miller. It's called A Million Miles in a Thousand Years. And he writes about story and what it means to live out a story, and goes through kind of the breakdown of how novels work and how movies work and what's the elements of a great story that's compelling to us that we get drawn to. And so kind of writes this memoir and reflection of kind of his journey through that. And when I read chapter 9, I put on my Facebook status about a year ago, I said, I wish every parent would read chapter 9 of this book. And so what I want to do is I just want to read you some excerpts from it, because I think it's helpful. Donald Miller writes this. He says, when I got back from Los Angeles, I got together with my friend Jason, who has a 13-year-old daughter. He was feeling down because he and his wife had found pot hidden in their daughter's closet. She was dating a guy, too, a kid who smelled like smoke and only answered questions with single words, yeah, no, whatever, and why. And why was the answer Jason hated most. Have her home by 10, Jason would say. Why? The guy would ask. Jason figured this guy was the reason his daughter was experimenting with drugs. You thinking about grounding her, I asked, not allowing her to date him? We've tried that, but it's just gotten worse. Jason shook his head, fidgeted with his fingers on the table. Then I said something that caught his attention. I said his daughter was living a terrible story. What do you mean, he asked. I don't know exactly, but she's not living a very good story. She's just caught up in a bad one. Said a lot of other things, and he kept asking questions. I mean, we must have talked for an hour or more just about story, about how novels work and why some movies are meaningful and others simply aren't. I didn't think much of it. I just figured he was curious about movies. But a couple months later, I ran into Jason and asked about his daughter. She's better, he said to me, smiling. And when I asked why, he told me his family was living a better story. Well, the night after we talked, Jason couldn't sleep. He thought about the story his daughter was living in, the role she was playing inside that story. He realized he hadn't provided a better role for his daughter. He hadn't mapped out a story for his family, and so his daughter had chosen another story, a story in which she was wanted, even if she was only being used. In the absence of a family story, she had chosen a story in which there was risk and adventure, rebellion and independence. She's not a bad girl, my friend said. She was just choosing the best story available to her. I pictured his daughter flipping through the channels of life, as it were, stopping on a story that seemed most compelling at the moment, a story that offered her something, anything, because people can't live without a story, without a role to play. So how did you get her out of it, I asked. And I couldn't believe what he told me next. Jason decided to stop yelling at his daughter and instead create a better story to invite her into. He remembered that a story involves a character who wants something and overcomes conflict to get it. That's how all good stories work. So I started researching some stuff on the internet, Jason said, and I came across an organization that builds orphanages around the world. And that sounded to me like a pretty good ambition. something maybe my family could try to do together. It sounded like a good story. So I called this organization, and it takes about $25,000 to build one of these orphanages. And the truth is, we don't have the money. I mean, we just took out a second mortgage, but I knew if we were going to tell a good story, it would have to involve risk. So I went home and called a family meeting. I didn't tell my wife first, which it turns out was a mistake. But I told them about this village and about the orphanage and all these terrible things that could happen if these kids don't get an orphanage. Then I told them I agreed to build it. And my wife sat there looking at me like I'd lost my mind. And my daughter, her eyes were as big as melons, and she was not happy. She knew this would mean she'd have to give up her allowance and who knows what else. They just sat there in silence. And the longer they sat there, the more I wondered if I'd lost my mind too. Jason went on to explain that his wife and daughter went back to their separate rooms and neither of them talked to him. His wife was rightly upset that he hadn't mentioned anything to her. But that night while they were lying in bed, he explained the whole story thing about how they weren't taking risk and they weren't helping anybody and how their daughter was losing interest. The next day, he said, "Annie, my wife came to me while I was doing the dishes." He collected his words. "Things had just been tense for the last year, Don. I haven't told you everything, but my wife came to me, put her arms around me, leaned her face into the back of my neck, and told me she was proud of me." Don, I hadn't heard Annie say anything like that in years. I told her I was sorry I didn't talk to her about it, that I just got excited. She said she forgave me, but that it didn't matter. She said we had an orphanage to build and that they were probably going to make bigger mistakes, but we would build it. And then our daughter Rachel came into our bedroom maybe a few days later and asked if we could go to Mexico where the orphanage was. And Annie and I were just sort of looked at her and didn't know what to say. And so then Rachel crawled between us in the bed like she did when she was little. She said that she could talk about the orphanage on her website and maybe people could help. She could post pictures. She wanted to go to Mexico to meet the kids and take pictures for her website. "That's incredible," I said. "You know what else, man?" Jason said. "She broke up with her boyfriend last week. She had his picture on her dresser and took it down and told me he said she was too fat. Can you believe that? What a jerk." "But that's done now," Jason said, shaking his head. "No girl who plays the role of a hero dates a guy who uses her. She knows who she is. She just forgot for a little while." So what kind of story are you inviting your kids into? Doesn't mean you have to build an orphanage in Mexico, but it also doesn't mean that you can just say, "Okay, well then that lets me off the hook," and treat it less significantly than it is. Because you need to wrestle with that. What kind of story am I inviting my kids into? But whatever it looks like, here's what my hope is for all of us. Is that in that story, we would be the kind of people that would look to respond to God, to listen to him, and to figure out what it looks like to move toward our kids and not distance ourselves from them. To not reenact our kids' poor behavior and their poor attitudes and their apathy when it comes, because they're gonna stumble just like all of us are. But that we'd figure out a way to move toward them and that we'd be the kind of people that would fight for their hearts, not with them. That we wouldn't be the kind of people that put walls up, but we'd be the kind of people that tear them down, and we would make sure that our kids know that we're always gonna fight for our relationship, that we're always gonna fight for their hearts, that we are for them. And then we would strategically invite other adults to help us and help our kids learn to live out a much better story, because we can't do it alone. Let's pray. Father, for a moment, I don't want to let it pass that we don't take a moment just to find ourselves grateful for the men and women who have given and who continue to give of themselves so that we have the freedom to gather in a place like this without fear of persecution and celebrate together and learn together. Very, very grateful on this weekend specifically. Father, I also pray that you would give us the courage as parents, as people who impact kids, to pay attention to what's going on inside of us. And that we would be the kind of people that fight for relationships, not only with our kids, but with all people. Not fight with people. and we would do the hard work of asking difficult questions so that we could live the kind of life that not only reflects your heart, that not only reflects your love, but we could live out a story that lines up with the very things that you care about, that we could live out a story that's compelling and inviting, that we can be proud of. We thank you, and we pray this in the name of Jesus. Amen. Thanks, friends. We'll see you next week.